good to be indoors with heat. There's a lot of good things about being together that you're just so thankful for. So thankful for your presence and the chance we have to worship together, to sing together, to break bread together. It's such a blessing to be a part of this family. We're thankful for you and for your presence. We know that there are a lot of people out, as Tommy mentioned, and we know that some of you are joining us online. We're thankful for you as well. I mentioned a couple of weeks ago, and some of you have come up and contacted me about the Daily Bread program that coordinates with Unity Hospital, carrying meals every day to those in our county who are medically unable to make their own meals, to stand over a stove or what have you. They're just not able to do that. And some of you have volunteered. So thankful for that. And if you would like to participate in that program, it's usually one or 2 days a month. It requires there's a route that will be given to you, and you're given specific places to go, and that route driving takes about 2 hours. Or you can work and coordinate at the hospital. That takes about 45 minutes just to separate the food out and put it where it needs to go. But we're getting a crew together, hopefully to do about 2 days a month. And if you would be interested in doing that, it's a great program. Just let me know. We're going to start giving the names of our volunteers to the coordinator for that. And she is going to make sure everybody is trained so you don't go into this thing blind. You know exactly what you're supposed to be doing and feel comfortable doing that before you're actually sent out. So anyway, just wanted to put in a little plug for that. Helmut James Graf von Moltke. Yeah, we don't get many of those names like that in America, but he was German. And he was drafted out of a very prominent family of German loyalists to work in counterintelligence in Nazi Germany. Now, you have to understand a little bit about Helmut. He comes from a long line of Helmut von Moltkes. In fact, his great uncle was, or his great great uncle was Helmut von Moltke. This is Helmut von Moltke the younger. That's his great uncle, and then his great great uncle was Helmut von Moltke the elder. Now, Helmut von Moltke the younger, he was a powerful German commander in World War I. His great-great-uncle was Helmut von Moltke, who was a Prussian field marshal in the Prussian, the Prusso-Franco Wars. And so he fought against Napoleon III, the first president. I mean, anyway, you get the idea. Very prominent, powerful military family. In fact, his great-great-uncle, Helmut von Moltke the elder, he was the field marshal of the Prussian army for 30 years and is credited for organizing and disseminating information in a much more modern way that made their army more efficient. So they were just, in fact, that's how Helmut James Graf, Graf was actually a title. It was a title, it was like Count. We would say it was something like Count, but that's how he got that title. It eventually becomes a part of the name. By the time it gets down to our Helmut James von Moltke. But this particular Helmut was different than his uncle and great-great-uncle. His Christian faith made him a very staunch opponent of Adolf Hitler. He also believed it was wrong, though, for him to use violent force against the Nazis. He was afraid that if Hitler were assassinated, then all of a sudden Hitler becomes a martyr and the next person steps up in their place and just continues the cycle. So he was adamantly against violence, even while being against the government. He loved his country, but he opposed the violence that they were committing. So he began working against that. In fact, in a letter that was smuggled out, he had a British friend. In a letter that was smuggled out to his British friend, he wrote, "Today, not a numerous, but an active part of the German people are beginning to realize, not that they've been led astray, not that bad times await them, not that the war may end in defeat, but that what is happening is sin, and that they are personally responsible for each terrible deed that has been committed. So what could he do?
What would you do?
What is the responsibility of the people of God when faced with ungodly leadership? We'll just put this in a little more practical terms. How do you, as an employee, deal with a boss or an owner of a company who is hurting you or who is hurting the company? How do you respond when a city or state or national leader is making poor decisions, even harmful decisions? Students, how do you react when you have a teacher or a coach who is just lazy or maybe just a bad teacher? What do you do when you have bad leadership? So as we continue our study through the book of Ecclesiastes, the preacher contemplates that same situation. He recognizes that God puts the leaders that are there, he puts them in their places, in their positions of authority, and at the same time, he knows that those leaders are sometimes going to make terrible decisions. Decisions that can even be life and death decisions. So what do we do when that happens? Ecclesiastes chapter 8, beginning at verse 1, it starts like this. It says, "Who is like the wise? Who knows the explanation of things? A person's wisdom brightens their face and changes its hard appearance." So he starts off talking about wisdom so we can know that whatever advice he's about to give for dealing with this situation, it's based on wisdom. This is what a wise person would do in this situation. So he goes on, continuing down there. Let's skip down to verse 4. He says, "Since a king's word is supreme, who can say to him, 'What are you doing?' Whoever obeys his command will come to no harm, and the wise heart will know the proper time and procedure. For there is a proper time and procedure for every matter, though a person may be weighed down by misery." Now, most often we think about Ecclesiastes being written by Solomon, and it may have been. Some have theorized that it is, that the person's a king. But here, this writer, the preacher, he calls himself, he takes the position of like a court advisor. And he says, if you go to the king and say, "What are you doing?" You just can't do that. As an advisor, you've got to pick your spots, right? So a wise person, he says, picks their spots. A wise person knows when to say and what to say. Now imagine you are in that position of advising a king who's making a terrible decision, maybe for the lives of the poor people, or for the lives of the military, or for the economic stability of your country. We might be tempted to do the very same thing that he advises against and go to the king and say, "What in the world are you doing?" In fact, for many of us, that's our first reaction. It's my first reaction, right? Whenever we see a principal or a governor or a manager or a leader that we believe is making a decision is misguided, we just want to go up to him and say, "What are you doing? You have no clue what you are about." In fact, that's really the idea that's come to dominate most of our political and even local news, right? Just random people. Authors, news anchors, pundits, experts, questioning those in power and asking, "What are you doing?" You can find entire news channels and newspapers and online websites that are dedicated to just really asking that question. What in the world is this person doing? The president or the senator or the governor or the school officials or who is, what in the world are they doing? What in the world are these coaches doing? I mean, yeah, that makes its way into the news as well. And that's not to say that that question is never appropriate. What he says, a wise person knows it's not always appropriate. That not every hill is a hill worth dying on. A wise person knows that and acts accordingly. A wise person picks their spots. And that's exactly what Helmut James von Moltke did.
rather than coming out and railing against the injustice of the Nazi army or taking a moral stand that kept him out of the office he was assigned to, he instead used his high position to rescue a lot of prisoners from certain death. And he was very successful at saving the lives of many people. Even so, he was eventually caught. He was arrested. He was put on trial. So we see this. We see situations like this. We see it happening in the businesses where we work or in the political world. And see the injustice of the entire thing. And we're like, how is this fair, right? How is injustice allowed to win? Why isn't wisdom victorious all of the time? Wouldn't it be great if that were the case? If every debate was settled by wisdom, if every dispute was settled by wisdom, if every disagreement that we had in our work lives or in our civic lives or even in our personal lives, if everything were settled by wisdom and the right thing and the right way always won out. But the preacher knows that's not the case. And so he continues on. He says, then too I saw the wicked buried. Right? You can imagine this. This is a person said, those who used to come and go from the holy place and receive praise in the city where they did this. This too is meaningless. A wicked leader dies and everybody gathers around. It's like, oh, this person was great. He's like, are you crazy? They were so wicked. And everybody's praising them. How can this be? Why is a wicked person who did bad things to all these people dying and being praised? This too is meaningless, he says. Although a wicked person who commits 100 crimes may live a long time, I know that it will go better with those who fear God, who are reverent before him. Yet because the wicked do not fear God, it will not go well with them, and their days will not lengthen like a shadow. So what does a wise person do when not only foolishness, but wickedness seems to be winning the day? And the preacher says, ultimately, the wise person trusts that God is still just. That the wise person looks and says, I don't understand it, but I believe that God knows what he's doing. Now, to our limited eyes, our human eyes, we readily pick out when injustice seems to be winning, right? We see crooked politicians who grow rich and get reelected. We see criminals, people who have committed or led organizations that have committed all these crimes. We see them not only grow wealthy, but seemingly grow old peacefully. We see, and if you've worked in business at any time at all, you see people that you think they're not very sharp at all, and they get promoted into a bigger leadership position, right? And we say, where's the justice? Where's God in all this? Like most of the world, we want to, more than anything, we want to rage against the machine, hence the title of the sermon. By the way, this is not an endorsement for you to go listen to the band Rage Against the Machine. Fantastic though they are, and I'm sure you're all tempted, probably already have them on your playlist. Not advocating for that. But the premise for their band name is they're looking out at society, and they're looking at government, and they're looking at the world, and they're saying, this is not right, and their music is essentially railing against all that they see that's wrong in the world, right? They're raging against the machine. So we want to take action. We want to make it stop. We want to make it all better. We want this person to stop and that person to be taken out of office. But the problem is, we're small. You and me, we're small. We're human. We're not in a position of power. We are limited in our power and position. So at some point, those among us who are wise have to have the grace and the wisdom to step back and acknowledge that God knows best, that God is ultimately still in control. Man, that is so difficult to do, isn't it? So difficult to step back and see the injustice and not be able to do anything about it. And you feel helpless, you feel weak, you feel small, and you're like, how is this right? How is this fair? And still acknowledge that God is in control. In his final letter to his beloved wife, Freya, our man, Helmut James von Moltke, he describes this dramatic moment at his trial, and the judge sort of launched into a tirade against his faith in Christ. And the judge says this, in only one respect does National Socialism, which was their government, he said, in only one respect does National Socialism resemble Christianity. He shouted, we also demand the whole man. You can't be all Christian if you're also going to be a part of our country. The judge then asks von Moltke to declare his loyalty. He says, from whom do you take your orders? From the other world or from Adolf Hitler? Where lies your loyalty and your faith? Now, von Moltke knew exactly where his loyalty lay, but he also knew the power of his answer. He had already put all of his hope, all of his trust in Jesus Christ. So he stood before the judge as a Christian and nothing else. Not a Christian German, not a German Christian. He just stood there. His faith enabled him to act wisely in his government service. And it now enabled him to act wisely in his final hour. As a believer in Christ, he understood the difference between the proper exercise of authority and the abuse of power. He also knew the wise course of action when he was under someone else's control and in danger for his own life. He knew that despite all appearances to the contrary, that this man was not going to be his judge, that ultimately God was going to be his judge. This morning, the word for wisdom, the word on behalf of wisdom for us, is to not rail and rage, but rather to be wise people who pick our spots and trust that God is still in control. May God give you the strength and the courage and the wisdom to do just that. And if you need prayers of encouragement, for strength, for forgiveness, if you need help in your Christian walk, we want you to know that we will do that with you and be here for you. If we can help you at all, won't you come as we stand and as we sing?